Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Steve Ringkamp on behalf of the plaintiff, Eddie Kluck. The following facts in this FELA case are uncontroverted. At a railroad authorized or mandated time and place, an entire railroad crew performing a railroad authorized or mandated task of unloading crew's luggage from a railroad authorized or mandated mode of transport, intending to go to a railroad authorized or mandated place of lodging for the crew, for a railroad authorized or mandated purpose of having those crews available to take trains of the railroad to their ultimate destinations, Eddie Kluck, the plaintiff, was injured when one railroad employee negligently forgot he had a loaded weapon stowed in his duffel bag that he allowed to be loaded with the safety off, and that employee failed to warn or unload or put the safety on or remove that weapon from his duffel. Now, the primary issue in this case is one very important issue related to agency and jury instructions. If the courts allow a railroad to avoid liability for its employees' negligence by focusing only on the character or nature of the negligent act itself and disregard all other factors or circumstances surrounding that negligent act, or give the railroad's rules prohibiting certain acts or omissions controlling or supreme weight under these circumstances, several things happen. The first is that it vitiates the mandate of 45 U.S.C. Section 51 for railroad liability for negligence of any of its employees. In pertinent part, that federal statute provides that every common carrier by railroad shall be liable for such injury or death resulting in whole or in part from the negligence of any of the officers, agents, or employees of the carrier. The second thing that happens if the railroad's position is adopted in this case is that it turns master-servant law on its head. The proper inquiry under master-servant law is always context of the negligent act. It is always the nature of the enterprise and whether the servant was negligent while performing acts in furtherance of that enterprise. The inquiry is always whether the course of conduct or the general activity of that negligent employee, not the specific negligent act, serves the interests of the master and is subject to the master's right of control. The truism in this case, and the truism for the principle of master and servant, is that the specific negligent act itself never serves the interest of the master. In fact, it results in liability. The third thing that happens...
Are there any exceptions, what, intentional torts or other things? What would acts would not be within the scope and course, even though the person was performing their job?
Well, the one of the classic cases is the Lavender case, which is cited by both parties. If there is no relationship to the performance of the employer's business, and it is a personal frolic or a deviation, then they are deemed not to be in the course and scope of employment.
And you're saying here the relationship to the business is not the gun, but it's unloading the baggage.
That's correct. Okay. It's really a very simple case. But what the railroad is asked the trial court and asked the appellate court in the Western District to do is zero in on the unauthorized act of bringing the gun. Well, if this court rules that way, then there should have been a directed verdict in the trial court. But when we look at the general principles of master-servant law, the real question becomes, was the conduct generally within the course and scope of employment? And for instance, MAI 18.01, when it advises lawyers and judges on how to fill in the blanks on an agency in issue case, its suggestion is that Driver Jones was operating the motor vehicle within the course and scope of employment, not that the employee violated the traffic signal within the scope and course of employment. If we stick in the wrong words, and the only thing that a jury gets to consider is whether violating the traffic signal was in the course and scope of employment, when we look at the definition of negligence, the second step of the definition of agency, the second step involved in this course and scope argument, we see that acts are within the course and scope when they serve the interests of the master. That's why I mentioned that phrase is so critical. Every MAI definition of agency has this language that the acts have to serve the interests of the master. Well, in this case, bringing a gun certainly wouldn't serve the interests of the master, but everything else in the surrounding context did. MAI says, in filling in the blanks, so to speak, in this definition of agency, a phrase describing the general conduct which is the subject of alleged deployment or agency, such as operation of the motor vehicle, that's what you stick in. Those are the operative facts that determine agency. What determines negligence is whether there was a violation of the traffic signal.
Here it was a failure to warn theory, so how does that fit in with this?
The failure to warn theory is just one of the possible acts of negligence on the part of the employee.
You don't fail to warn that you're going to violate the traffic signal or that you're not. What are you saying they should have submitted as the failure to warn?
Oh, they could have submitted any number of things, the failure to warn of the presence of the weapon, the failure to unload it, the failure to put the safety on, any of those things, or failure to remove it altogether. Any of those things could have happened. But what's important under 45 U.S.C. Section 51 is that the injured employee be in the course and scope of employment, and that another employee injured that person within at the time or as an employee of the railroad. So it's this definitional problem that we have if we get to a jury instruction point. That is of great interest, I believe, to this court. And what MAI asks for, namely the general conduct, be submitted as the operative facts for the agency finding, only makes sense because it's consistent with the body of law for master and servant. For instance, in the auto case, it's the operation of the vehicle, not the driving while intoxicated or texting and driving or failing to keep a careful lookout. Those are deviations from the employment. But that's what renders liability. What renders liability on the master is that those negligent acts are done during the course of employment. The medical malpractice case, it is the provision of health care that is important, or that the doctor has to perform on behalf of a corporation that serves the interests of the master. It's not operating on the wrong leg that the jury has to find serves the interests of the master. They certainly wouldn't. It's not severing the nerve that a jury has to find would serve the interests of master.
And in fact, the committing negligence is never serving
That's
the interests
correct.
Of the master, so you'd never have a claim.
And here's the problem with the railroad's approach. If the only act that is ever submitted to the jury as the frame of reference for making this determination of whether the employee was acting in the course and scope of employment, if the only act that the jury ever sees in the jury instructions is the negligent act itself, a jury is always going to stand back and say, well, severing the nerve in the leg certainly didn't serve the interests of the master.
So was the Western District's proposed instruction incorrect, where they said you submit employee was negligent in carrying a gun to work and that was in the scope and course of employment?
Well, actually, what the Western District said was that the jury had to, that MAI 24.01A should be modified with a paragraph that said defendant's employee was thereby negligent while acting in the scope of his employment. But in a footnote says, well, you got to use one of the definitions from MAI as to what scope of employment means. And that's where the fill-in-the-blank problem comes around. And that's where the railroad issue becomes so problematic for the trial courts and the attorneys. Do you stick in for acts? Do you stick in the employee brought a gun. You have to find that bringing the gun was within the course and scope of employment. Plaintiff loses. Or do you have to find that unloading the baggage was within in the scope and course of employment?
Do you have a problem with the Western District saying it should be in paragraph 2 as opposed to which paragraph, how they submitted it?
It's just a technical problem, Judge. It's not MAI to add that language. The proper language is to modify 2401A with an 1801 modification. That's just a technical thing. It gets to the same point. And the point is whether there is, what is the act that has to be within the course and scope of employment? Is it the specific act of negligence or is it the general conduct?
Can you also address lost my question, but I'll get it to you before.
That's all right.
The Western District said that it was the trial judge's responsibility to draft the proper instruction.
That was it?
Yeah.
Is that in accordance with established law?
In a sense. I'm not sure it was. It's quite as direct as the Western District would make it.
If no party offers a correct instruction, does the trial court violate its duty if it doesn't just create one on its own?
I think so.
Well,
but
according to
I don't think we get that to that here, because there were tenders of instructions that attempted to comply with 2401A and the definition of agency.
But that's the question. If they attempted to but didn't do it correctly, then doesn't the party who claims error have an obligation to present a correct instruction?
Yes. The obligation to present instructions are with the trial lawyer. They ultimately become those of the trial judge.
In your opinion, was a proper instruction tendered in this case?
Yes, there actually were several. There were attempts. The problem in this case was that the trial judge, by virtue of all the rulings, essentially was holding that plaintiffs had to prove that bringing the gun was in the course and scope of employment.
Right.
Anything else the trial judge would not allow.
Right. But from purely standard review, the way I understand the comments in MAI, the non-delegable duty to give a correct instruction is only upon the trial court when it decides to do the instruction itself.
That's correct.
And so the standard of review then is that the plaintiff has an obligation to tender a correct instruction.
That's true.
And if he does, and the trial court doesn't give it, then he's reviewed for abuse of discretion, correct?
And the problem here, Judge, was that the trial judge refused to allow plaintiff to submit a theory, namely imputed liability, mm-hmm. when the law and the facts allowed that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then the review on the law is a de novo review, is that correct?
Yes.
But I'm because it sounds like you're saying two different. Everybody has the duty, and of course we review for error. I mean, if the plaintiff submits a correct instruction, the court needs to give it. The court needs to submit in accordance with plaintiff's theory of the case. But if plaintiff does not submit a correct instruction on their theory of the case, are you saying the trial judge has an independent duty to make one up, or the plaintiff gets a new trial?
No, that's the plaintiff's problem.
Okay.
I'm not trying to.
That's what I was trying.
That's why I said I think they were too strict in the Western District in their analysis of that.
Right.
But we don't need to get to that issue.
But you're saying the error here is that plaintiff was not entitled to, not allowed to submit on their theory of the case.
On imputed negligence, and clearly the law is that the plaintiff was entitled to. And so when the trial court required the case to be submitted under MAI 2401B. Mm-hmm. The direct negligence of the railroad, that was error because part of that instruction is that there had to be evidence that the railroad, other than Mr. Clark, had knowledge or knew or should have known of bringing the gun before there was liability.
And doesn't that make total sense? In other words, if the plaintiff submits an instruction that is correct, the trial court has an obligation to give it.
That's correct.
If the trial judge thinks that the instruction is not in compliance and decides to draft his own or her own, then there's no doubt that they have a non-delegable duty to get it right.
That's correct.
In other words, the trial court really has two chances to get it right.
That's right.
They can take an instruction that will be reviewed under abuse of discretion that they think is right and give it, or be reviewed as being wrong under abuse of discretion, or they have an absolute obligation if they take it on to do it absolutely correct.
That's right. And under those circumstances, maybe I didn't understand your question, Judge Stith, but if the trial judge takes it upon himself or herself,
I understand. That was not part. That's a clarification.
Either party would have the right to complain.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
May it please the court, Craig Leff on behalf of the respondent, Union Pacific Railroad Company. Before getting into the instructional issues, I just wanted to address some of the factual statements presented by opposing counsel that were represented to be uncontroverted. First and foremost, the supposition that this accident occurred as the employees were unloading their luggage. The evidence presented at trial, all of it in Mr. Kluck's case in chief through his testimony and the testimony of Larry Clark, is that Mr. Kluck himself was unloading the bags at the back of the van, and Mr. Clark, according to his testimony, was standing near the front door of the hotel and didn't see what happened but heard a pop and went back and then saw Mr. Kluck with a gunshot wound to his knee. So he was not involved in the unloading of the luggage, and this unloading of the luggage is one of these evolving themes that seems to be kind of consistent with a case where the plaintiffs aren't quite sure what theory they want to address. The unloading of the luggage was never submitted in any of the proposed instructions, for example, that were tendered to the court.
But did the fellow employee bring the gun onto the premises?
The fellow employee, Mr. Clark, had put the gun into his grip or his duffel bag while it was sitting in his pickup truck off property, and then he brought the duffel bag to work, and the testimony was...
So he brought the duffel bag to work?
He brought the duffel bag
to
work.
With the gun on, without a safety?
It loaded without the safety on, correct.
Right.
And Mr. Kluck was traveling with other employees to Arkansas, from Arkansas to a hotel in Coffeyville for purposes of work, and they reached a hotel and he was unloading their luggage.
That's correct.
So what part of that is not in the course and scope of employment?
As to Mr. Kluck being within the course and scope, that wasn't disputed. We agreed that Mr. Kluck was on duty and that therefore the railroad would be responsible to the extent it was liable for Mr. Clark's conduct. Our position was that under the normal common law principles of respondeat superior, Mr. Clark's packing a loaded weapon in his gun for purposes wholly unrelated to work.
But his traveling and bringing a suitcase and going to this location was within the scope and course. What is your response to Mr. Ringkamp's argument that your argument is like saying, well, running the red light was not in the scope and course? And he says, no, but driving was. Here, carrying a gun may not have been within the scope and course, but traveling with luggage to a place where you're going to do business was.
The carrying of the gun was so unrelated to anything that he was supposed to accomplish as a locomotive engineer for the railroad that
carrying luggage when he's traveling on behalf of the railroad is something that's in the scope of employment. It's anticipated by the... I'm sure by the railroad that you carry stuff, you'd be packed and carry stuff with you, and they assume you're carrying luggage, and inside the luggage is a loaded gun, just like in Paul's graph, having firecrackers in the that weren't expected.
Right. I mean, carrying luggage is. Carrying a loaded firearm is not, and there was no testimony.
The question is, if we accept your argument, then a violation of a rule would never be within the course and scope of employment.
Not at all. I think the violation of a rule goes to the factual issue of whether he was acting within the course and scope and bringing a loaded weapon to work. Obviously, we can't pass a law that says thou shalt not be negligent, and then when someone's negligent, say, well, that's not on us because we told you not to do that. But here, his act of bringing a loaded weapon to work was so unrelated to his job, and all the testimony was to the effect that it had nothing to do with his job as an engineer. He didn't bring the gun to work to protect himself or others or defend off animals or burglars or anyone else. It's akin to the situation in the Gallows case decided by the Second Circuit, in which the employee who was working in kind of a seedy neighborhood thought it would be prudent to bring a German Shepherd mix with her for protection and kept it in a locked bathroom. And then the dog got out and bit a security man. And he said, the railroad's liable. The Second Circuit said, in order to determine whether the bringing of the dog to work is something that the railroad's liable for, you need to look at the purpose of it and whether it furthered the railroad's interest. And it said there was a fact issue in that case because the woman had testified that she was afraid of the people and the vagrants and other unseemly characters and therefore brought it for protection. The court noted, however, that if the only evidence was that she brought the dog to work because she didn't have a dog sitter or because she liked company, then that's not something on the railroad. The mere fact that it occurs during working hours is not enough. That's
well, then what about Mr. Ringkamp saying that's comparable to saying it obviously furthers nothing of the employer to have an accident, to go through a red light, to drive negligently? So if we're going to say whatever the negligent act was has to be intended at least to further the employer's job, wouldn't it apply there?
Mr. Ringkamp brought up the issue of somebody driving, for example, mm-hmm. but was operating an automobile is in the course and scope and running the red light. Well, operating the automobile is within the course and scope, and running the red light is the manner in which he was negligent in doing that job.
Right.
It would be like the Frito-Lay driver who's driving and runs over a child who runs out in the street. Frito-Lay is responsible for it. If the Frito-Lay driver is on his way home and stops off to do an errand for his employer, that's called the dual-purpose doctrine. If the Frito-Lay driver has a dirty bomb in the back of his truck and it detonates, Frito-Lay is not responsible.
Is there a difference because this is a FELA action?
Absolutely not. The common law principles that courts have consistently applied are those from the common law. And the Second Circuit, the Seventh Circuit, the Tenth Circuit have all reaffirmed that the test for respondeat superior is strictly out of the common law. And the Congress and the Supreme Court have said that the ordinary respondeat superior, or ordinary negligence principles apply unless Congress or the Supreme Court have said otherwise. And they haven't relaxed that standard.
What if the bag had been badly closed and, say, it fell open or something heavy fell out and injured him when he was unpacking it?
I think that's a different case. Because
I'm just trying to see where the line would be. How do we decide what's within the reasonable? Is it a foreseeability test, or is that a different element, and you don't look at foreseeability?
I think certainly there's a question of foreseeability, but this case, it was so patently obvious that the act causing injury was a 9mm loaded derringer with a safety off that was put into his bag to keep it out of plain sight when he had tried to hook up with a friend to show it to him to sell it. There has to be a connection, and obviously the railroad's prohibition on guns is certainly relevant considering it. So at a minimum, there's a factual issue as to whether his conduct was in the course and scope, and also as to whether Mr. Clark, who testified he'd forgotten that the gun was even in his bag, whether he was negligent in failing to warn. This was not a case where there was only one conclusion, and most of the evidence used to support it came from the plaintiff himself. And a directed verdict is never based upon what the plaintiff's evidence is, especially where he bears the burden of proof on negligence. I would submit that a lot of these questions on the instructional issues, though, are academic because they've been waived. At the court below, Mr. Cluck, and this brings into questions
well,
the respective.
If you offer an instruction and then the trial court turns down the instruction, I mean, isn't that pretty much what the plaintiff has to do in order to be entitled to review?
In part, Your Honor.
What else do you have to do other than offer? Assuming you offer an instruction
right.
That would be appropriate.
You need to tender an instruction that's correct given the law and the facts.
Mm-hmm.
If the court accepts it, then the instruction is given. If the court rejects it, then you appeal the decision of the trial court and you call into question her rejection of a specific instruction, arguing why it was correct under the law and the facts.
Right.
That was not done at the Court of Appeals. Mr. Cluck's point relied on number one, which is now a point relied on number two, said the court erred in not giving an instruction based on 2401A, period. It didn't point to any instruction that should have been given, explain why the court erred in not giving it, explain why that instruction was not correct given the law and the facts, and in fact...
In fact,
Mr. Cluck argued at the Court of Appeals that no modification of 2401A was appropriate to submit the question of respondeat superior because you can't modify it 2401A, B, because the FELA doesn't incorporate respondeat superior, and C, that the uncontrovertible facts were that they were acting within the course and scope. They did not submit that Judge Messley erred in refusing any instruction. And the Court of Appeals did not find that she erred in refusing any instruction.
Well, don't they raise the claim that they wanted to instruct on a theory that of imputed negligence, and the trial court would not allow them to do so?
Well, that happens all the time, Your Honor. You have to submit an instruction to create the error, though. And if you don't submit a proper instruction and then call it to the attention
the court can't pick a different theory of your case than the one you want to submit on.
No, but if the plaintiff's position was that Judge Messley erred in failing to submit their theory, then the way you do it is you go to the Western District and you say, Judge Messley erred in refusing instruction 7D. They didn't do that. And now on appeal, they've materially changed their point relied upon and are now altering the basis for their claim before this court, which is in plain violation of Rule 8308, which says you can't do that. They did not call into question any particular instructions, and there's a simple way to appeal the decision. You tender the instruction to the trial court, and if the trial court rejects it, you appeal for refusal of the instruction.
And in the meantime, what did they submit?
Well, in this case, the judge submitted on her own a direct negligence theory.
And that wasn't their theory. Was that proper?
It was their alternative theory, and they have not appealed her giving of that instruction. Again, if they submitted it that it was wrong to give that instruction, they need to have a point relied upon, they need to appeal that decision directly, and they didn't do that either. So what they've done is, at the Court of Appeals, they said, we tried seven different times.
I guess what you're saying is that you at least agree with the part of the conversation I had with opposing counsel, that there's at least two reviewable events that occurred in this case, and maybe multiple depending upon the number of alternatives permitted. The reviewable event is when the instruction is tendered, and that's reviewed, use of discretion, right or wrong, however many different ones there were. And the other event is when the trial judge decides to give her own instruction. At that point, you'd agree, she does have a non-delegable duty to offer a correct instruction under the facts and law.
Absolutely, and in fact, she did so here, and the plaintiff agreed that the instruction was proper in form and substance to submit their alternative theory as found by the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals took the unprecedented step of saying that because Mr. Kluck submitted seven different instructions and each of them had certain elements that, if cobbled together, might have given her the idea of what should be submitted, it was incumbent upon her to submit an instruction from the court, not an option. It was mandatory. And that's the only case that I've been able to find in the history of Missouri jurisprudence in which a trial judge was reversed on instructional error without finding that an instruction given was erroneous or that it was error to refuse any instruction.
What should happen at the trial level, say, if the trial court honestly believes that all the instructions offered are bad? Do they just keep offering and refusing them? At some point, you got to go to the jury. How do you resolve that?
I don't know, but I can tell you that in this case, the jury instruction conference spanned 3 days. We came in on a Sunday, and we went late on Friday, we came in on Sunday, and we continued on Monday. And we've been talking about instructions throughout the trial. We made very clear what we thought needed to be in an instruction, as did the judge, and the plaintiffs didn't submit one that comported with her ideas. They submitted alternative ones. If they believed that one of their instructions was correct and should have been given, it was incumbent upon them to tell the Court of Appeals that by name and not just give them seven. Basically, they just said the court should have done it on her own, and this is the type of instruction that it should be based on. That's meaningless in the context of a case where you're trying to accuse a trial court of error in the refusal of an instruction.
Did the defense offer an alternative instruction?
No.
And do they have an obligation to?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe there's been any case that has required us to do it, nor has there been any case that has said that the judge has an obligation to submit an instruction on behalf of a party who can't get it right. I don't know. Perhaps what happens if the party refuses to submit an appropriate instruction, I suppose there's an option of a mistrial. There's the other option that the court says, I'm going to give this instruction on my own. And if she does that, then it's up to the judge to make sure that instruction is correct. But what a party who bears the burden of submitting an instruction cannot do is what's been done here. And that is simply submit seven different instructions and then at the Court of Appeals say, I'm not going to call into question the validity or correctness of any one of the instructions. I'm just going to say that the judge should have done it. And that was the only ground on which the Western District reversed. It created a new law in which the trial court now has the duty to submit an instruction on behalf of a party who can't or won't submit one correctly. And our position is that they had multiple opportunities. She did express her views of the case, but she gave them every opportunity to submit an instruction that comported with their understanding of the law and the facts of the case. And if their contention is that the trial court erred in refusing it, there is a simple process to appeal that decision. And that was to, in their brief to the Western District Court of Appeals, write down point relied on one. The trial court erred in refusing instruction number 7D because and then explain why, and then explain in the body of the brief. If you look at the brief, and you look at the body of the brief and the point relied upon in their brief at the Court of Appeals, they don't identify any of the instructions by number. They don't identify any of the instructions by substance. And in fact, they deny that any modifications for respondent superior would have been warranted. Now they're saying that the trial court erred in not giving an instruction.
Well, they did offer at least two that submitted respondent superior.
They did, but they didn't ask the Court of Appeals to judge whether they were correct. And so what happened is the Court of Appeals had a large multiple choice exam, basically, because there were seven different instructions, yet none of them was argued as being correct.
And you're arguing under our rules they cannot raise a different error here in the Supreme Court than they raised in the Court of Appeals.
Correct, Your Honor, and that's specifically out of the cases we cited in the brief, and I believe it was the Cone case, where somebody attacking a decision on an instruction can't make new arguments that were not made to the Court of Appeals.
But they could argue that the instruction the court gave was improper. But they didn't argue that either, you're
saying? They have not argued that either.
So what did they argue in the Court of Appeals?
They argued in the Court of Appeals that the trial court should have given an instruction based on MAI 2401A. That's it. And 2401A has a variety of permutations and variations depending on the facts of the case. And so
should have submitted an imputed negligence instruction. And they offered two such. But you're saying that was inadequate to raise the court's error in denying, arguably, or correctly or incorrectly, those two instructions?
To correctly preserve error at an appellate court, you have to, in your brief, point out which decision of the trial court you're challenging and why. That wasn't done. All they said is that the trial court should have given an instruction based on...
But the trial court did refuse to give an imputed negligence instruction and said you have to submit a direct negligence instruction.
Not at all, Your Honor. She refused to give the instructions that they tendered. They tendered the instructions to her. She tendered them on the record. There was a record made in the instruction conference, and they said, we're tendering these alternative instructions, and there are seven of them. And she said, I'm rejecting this one because it's wrong, this one because it's wrong, and this one because it's wrong.
And then how did we get the direct negligence instruction?
She gave that on her own because it was easier under MAI because there was less, basically because 2401B, I believe, is for a direct negligence theory based on the negligence of the railroad itself. It's the direct alternative theory that they pled and that they agreed was in proper form to submit that alternative theory. But she gave them ample opportunity to submit instructions, and in fact they did submit them, but then at the Court of Appeals never contended that any of them was correct or that she erred in refusing them. And now they're trying to smuggle in new arguments before this court that weren't raised at the Court of Appeals.
Are any other further questions?
I have one. Counselor, I know this is not this case, but my question is that there's an increasing number of pro se litigants. And obviously this case had competent lawyers on both sides of it, and yet there was disagreement as to the jury instructions. If a pro se plaintiff was unable to draft an instruction that would pass muster with the trial court or later an appellate court, could a trial court simply refuse to give the instructions and not be subject to reversal?
I think under the rules, a party bearing the burden of proof on an issue shall, that's mandatory, shall submit an instruction. And if that party does not submit an instruction, it cannot allege error in the refusal of that instruction.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
May it please the court. In reading the briefs, these issues of jury instructions were clearly presented to the trial court. As a matter of fact, with regard to 20, the direct negligence instruction, counsel in the transcript indicated that this amounted to a directed verdict in favor of the defendant, and in fact, that's what ended up happening.
But they're arguing not that it wasn't presented to the trial court. They're arguing that a different claim of error was made in the Western District.
I didn't see that at all as I read the briefs, Your Honor. I did not write either of the briefs, but I didn't see that at all. It's very consistent.
I think what they're arguing is they had to object to an error in submission of direct negligence, and plaintiff's counsel is saying we could object to the whole concept of direct negligence. If you're going to submit it, that might or might not have been right, but it wasn't our theory. And
actually, if you want, what they're saying is that they argue you have to raise that the trial court erred in not submitting instruction number A. Trial court erred in not submitting instruction number B.
And that was done in the Court of Appeals.
But in the Court of Appeals, didn't they argue, rather than saying it was an error in rejecting a particular instruction, they said if the court's going to make one up, it's got to make one up on our theory of the case. So the court erred in making one up on a theory we didn't want to submit.
Well, that argument was made, too. So all of these arguments were made both in the Court of Appeals
so and here. So about the imputed negligence, that the instruction was offered to the trial court, she refused to take it, then it was referred to as error in the Court of Appeals, was it? And then the Court of Appeals did not rule on that. Is that correct?
It's been consistent throughout.
And the motion for new trial as well?
Yeah. I have to admit I didn't read that, but I believe so.
Mr. Rinkamp, I know you don't think that's the situation here, but what are you saying the trial judge should do in a situation where the plaintiff offers 5, 10, 15 verdict directors and none of them are in fact correct under the law? Does the court then have an independent obligation, or does defendant have to offer something? Do you take the best of a bad lot, or what is the...
There are any number of options. And I
there's nothing in the instructions book that would
suggest
how to deal
with that
situation.
No, there isn't, that says. The initial obligation is on plaintiff counsel to submit their own instructions
and a correct instruction.
Yeah.
Right.
Sure. In my view, any number of those instructions that were tendered were correct, but all were refused on the basis that they were imputed negligence instructions.
But hypothetically, if a plaintiff has an obligation to submit a correct instruction and they do not do it, what is the trial court's remedy?
To either submit one that is correct, and that's really the only option I know of at this point.
Well, you're saying then that the trial court has an obligation to write their own instructions and submit them when they are not presented a correct one, and that isn't the state of the law.
Counsel, I don't know that we have an answer to that anywhere, and I don't know of any case that answers that question.
And but you're saying we don't need to reach it here?
Not here, no.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.